Desert Storm and End of the Bolshevik Myth. In June of 1989, far-reaching student-led demonstrations massed in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Hardline leaders commanded the military to enforce martial law in China's capital and forcibly suppress the protests. Troops with assault rifles and tanks inflicted casualties on unarmed civilians trying to block the military's advance towards Tiananmen Square, which student demonstrators had occupied for 7 weeks. The demonstrations received broad support from city residents, exposing deep splits within China's political leadership. Mao Zedong, 1893-1976, was the founding father of the People's Republic of China. His Marxist-Leninist theories and political policies are collectively known as Maoism. Wikipedia.org. George H.W. Bush became the 41st U.S. president in 1989, beating Michael Dukakis, whose election campaign was subject to several gaffes on issues like capital punishment and a ludicrous tank incident. Dukakis appeared on TV riding in a tank, looking comical in an oversized helmet like a Snoopy dog hat. In August 1990, the dictator of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, ordered his army across the border into tiny Kuwait. Iraq's army was strongly equipped. The United States had provided massive military aid to Iraq during their 8-year war with Iran, giving them the fourth largest army in the world. Kuwait was a major supplier of oil to the United States. The Iraqi takeover posed an immediate threat to neighboring Saudi Arabia, another major exporter of oil. If Saudi Arabia fell to Saddam, Iraq would control 1/5 of the world's oil supply. In the last months of 1990, the United States participated in the defense of Saudi Arabia in a deployment known as Operation Desert Shield. Over 500,000 American troops were placed in Saudi Arabia in case of an Iraqi attack on the Saudis. The U.S. further sought multilateral support in the United Nations Security Council, which condemned Iraq and helped form a coalition to fight Saddam militarily. Looking westward for backing for their dramatic domestic changes, the Soviet Union did not block the American plan. On January 17, 1991, American and Allied forces began launching air attacks on Iraqi forces, and on February 24 the Operation Desert Storm ground campaign began. By February 27, the coalition had achieved their stated mission of ejecting the Iraqi army out of Kuwait. Exactly 100 hours after the ground battle had begun, the Allies suspended all offensive operations. While Bush's decision to conclude the war without removing Saddam Hussein from power would become controversial, his advisors would recall that the president was insistent that the war should not exceed the authorization of the Security Council. Interviewed in 2007, when the U.S. had been fighting in Iraq for more than 4 years in a war initiated by Bush's son, President George W. Bush, Colin Powell remarked, "In recent months, nobody's been asking me about why we didn't go to Baghdad. Pretty good idea now why Baghdad should always be looked at with some reservations." American Experience, The Persian Gulf War, PBS. Millions of dollars of valuables were plundered by Saddam's occupying troops. As Iraq retreated, they detonated explosives at many of Kuwait's oil wells. The disaster to the environment grew as Iraq dumped oil into the Persian Gulf. The costs were enormous, and casualty figures staggering. Although estimates range in the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi deaths, only 148 Americans were killed in the battle. This was primarily because of the technological advances of the United States. The Persian Gulf War was a television event. CNN broadcast round-the-clock coverage of unfolding events. Americans saw footage from cameras placed on smart bombs as they struck Iraqi targets. The stealth fighter, designed to avoid radar detection, was put into use for the first time. General Norman Schwarzkopf and General Colin Powell became household names as citizens watched their direction of the conflict. Operation Desert Storm, USHistory.org. Journalist Edward Mortimer wrote in the New York Review of Books in November 1990, "It seems far more likely that Saddam Hussein went ahead with the invasion because he believed the U.S. would not react with anything more than verbal condemnation. That was an inference he could well have drawn from his meeting with U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie on July 25, and from statements by State Department officials in Washington at the same time publicly disavowing any U.S. security commitments to Kuwait, but also from the success of both the Reagan and the Bush administrations in heading off attempts by the U.S. Senate to impose sanctions on Iraq for previous breaches of international law. U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie met with Saddam on July 25, 1990. She believed entirely in the Bush plan to moderate Saddam Hussein and to make him a U.S. ally. She took as her brief a memo that had arrived from Secretary of State James Baker the previous day. Hussein asked for permission from the U.S., via their ambassador April Glaspie, and got an answer that the U.S. does not care about Arab quarrels. That was a trap, and after Saddam occupied Kuwait, George Bush Sr. mobilized a coalition of some 40 nations to liberate Kuwait and to smash the recently built Iraqi military power base. This also involved a media hoax, where the daughter of Kuwaiti U.S. ambassador played nurse on TV and testified to witnessing Iraqi soldiers throwing babies out of incubators in Kuwait. History of American False Flag Operations, 911 Review. Elusiveness like that had caused the Korean War 40 years earlier, when Secretary of State Dean Acheson had neglected to include South Korea in America's East Asian security perimeter. The North Koreans had interpreted that omission as license to invade the South. In 1990, Saddam saw an opening in Baker's apparent indifference on the border issue. What if he left Kuwait largely intact, but seized the Rumaila oil field and one or two of Kuwait's islands? Perhaps the Bush administration would permit that. "Do not push us to invade Kuwait," Saddam growled to Ambassador Glaspie. "Do not make it the only option left with which we can protect our dignity." Jeffrey Varro, Desert Storm Turns 20, What Really Happened in 1991, and Why It Matters. Huffington Post, January 22, 2011. Gossip on the Democratic Underground blog said that April Glaspie died in a car crash in February 2003, Bernie Ward on KGO reported her dead. Glaspie was apparently consul general in South Africa in 2000. When she denied her statements to Saddam Hussein, she disappeared into obscurity as an ambassador in residence at a San Diego university. In 1993, she returned to active duty at the State Department's Bureau of African Affairs, where she was criticized for provoking Somalia's warlord Mohamed Aid's hostility. In January 1995, Glaspie took over operations of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the West Bank, The Independent, March 13, 1995. By April 1995, Glaspie was reportedly in a turf battle with the UN Special Envoy responsible for distributing aid in Gaza, The Washington Times, April 28, 1996. Radio listeners distinctly remembered Bernie Ward saying that she died in a car accident. But no indication at all that April Glaspie had died could be found in any government news reports, and the bios have been scrubbed so there is no year of death on any government site. It was argued that Glaspie's statements that "we have no opinion on your Arab-Arab conflicts" and that "the Kuwait issue is not associated with America" were interpreted by Saddam as giving free rein to handle his disputes with Kuwait as he saw fit. It was also argued that Saddam would not have invaded Kuwait had he been given an explicit warning that such an invasion would be met with force by the United States. Once Upon a Time in America is a 1984 Italian epic crime drama film co-written and directed by Sergio Leone and starring Robert De Niro and James Woods. The movie tells the story of David Noodles Aronson, Robert De Niro, and his past buddies, Prohibition-era gangsters from New York City. A senator named Chris Bailey is under investigation for corruption. Several witnesses set to testify against Bailey have all died under mysterious circumstances. Noodles goes to Bailey's Long Island mansion and meets directly with the senator, who reveals himself to be his old gang friend Maximilian Max Berkovic, James Woods. Max had faked his own death during the liquor exchange where he was killed and has, for the past 30 years, created the Senator Bailey identity fraud as a disguise. In December of 1991, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics broke up into 15 separate countries. The collapse of the Soviet Union changed the entire world political stage. It was hailed by the West as a victory for freedom, a triumph of democracy over totalitarianism, and evidence of the superiority of capitalism over socialism. The United States rejoiced as its formidable enemy was brought to its knees, thereby ending the Cold War, which had hovered over these two superpowers since the end of World War II. The Soviet Union was built on approximately the same territory as the Russian Empire it succeeded. After the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, the newly formed government developed a philosophy of socialism with the eventual and gradual transition to communism. The new state, which was built on a communist ideology, was eventually transformed into a totalitarian state, in which the communist leadership had complete control over the country. Been away so long I hardly knew the place. Gee, it's good to be back home. Leave it till tomorrow to unpack my case. Honey, disconnect the phone. I'm back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the US, back in the US. Back in the USSR. The Beatles, back in the USSR, 1968. The Soviets underestimated the degree to which the non-Russian ethnic groups in the country, which comprised more than 50% of the total population of the Soviet Union, would resist assimilation into a Russianized state. Their economic plan failed to meet the requirements of the state, which was bogged down in a fierce arms race with the United States. This led to gradual economic decline, eventually necessitating the need for reform. The ideology of communism, which the Soviet government worked to instill in the hearts and minds of its population, never took firm root, and eventually lost whatever influence it had originally carried. The Gulag Archipelago, 1973, was Alexander Solzhenitsyn's non-fictional masterwork, an account of prisons, camps, transit centers, and secret police. It is about the detention and routine killing of millions of innocent Soviet citizens by their government, mostly during Joseph Stalin's rule from 1929 to 1953. The work is based on the witness of around 200 survivors, and on the memory of Solzhenitsyn's own existence in labor camps and exile. Archipelago refers to the outlying assortment of forced labor camps run and enlarged by the secret police and its institutions, whose prisoner population grew after the revolution of 1917 from small numbers to 12 to 15 million at any one time by the 1940s. Gulag is the acronym of the central office that administered the penal camps. Solzhenitsyn was a mathematics teacher in the old Russian town of Ryazan who spent 8 years in Stalin's concentration camps. His first literary work, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, 1962, is the simple story of a common carpenter, one of millions viciously imprisoned for countless years on baseless charges, sentenced to the true life nightmares of the Soviet work camps in Siberia. Finally, the situation came to a head in August of 1991. In a last-ditch effort to save the Soviet Union, which was floundering under the impact of the political movements which had emerged since the implementation of Gorbachev's glasnost, a group of hardline communists organized a coup d'état. They kidnapped Gorbachev, and then, on August 19 of 1991, they announced on state television that Gorbachev was very ill and would no longer be able to govern. The country went into an uproar. Massive protests were staged in Moscow, Leningrad, and many of the other major cities of the Soviet Union. When the coup organizers tried to bring in the military to quell the protesters, the soldiers themselves rebelled, saying that they could not fire on their fellow countrymen. After 3 days of massive protest, the coup organizers surrendered, realizing that without the cooperation of the military, they did not have the power to overcome the power of the entire population of the country. After the failed coup attempt, it was only a few months until the Soviet Union completely collapsed. Both the government and the people realized that there was no way to turn back the clock. The massive demonstrations of the August days had demonstrated that the population would accept nothing less than democracy. Gorbachev conceded power, realizing that he could no longer contain the power of the population. On December 25, 1991, he resigned. By January of 1992, by popular demand, the Soviet Union ceased to exist. In its place, a new entity was formed. It was called the Commonwealth of Independent Republics, and was composed of most of the independent countries of the former Soviet Union. While the member countries had complete political independence, they were linked to other Commonwealth countries by economic, and, in some cases, military ties. Fall of the Soviet Union, the Cold War Museum. Boris Yeltsin led the protesters who defeated the coup. He was the first freely elected president of the Russian Federation. In November of 1996, he underwent a quintuple heart bypass operation. Boris Yeltsin voluntarily resigned from the post after 9 years, leaving Vladimir Putin to be the acting president until the next elections. Yeltsin died at the age of 76 on April 23, 2007. The Berlin Wall stood for nearly 30 years, splitting the city of Berlin into Communist East Berlin and Democratic West Berlin, from its construction in 1961 to its destruction in 1989. The physical wall itself was largely bulldozed in 1990. Memories of the wall, nonetheless, were still very much alive. The world is closing in. Did you ever think that we could be so close, like brothers? The future's in the air. I can feel it everywhere. Blowing with the wind of change. Take me to the magic of the moment. On a glory night. Where the children of tomorrow dream away. In the wind of change. Scorpions, Wind of Change, 1991. When Nazism emerged as a political force, the global economic state of affairs staggered between two patterns of social organization, fading aristocracy and growing democracy. The concept of a noble class is basically a European one, first established in the Middle Ages. At the pinnacle of the pyramid stood the aristocrats, ranging from a king down to lesser peers, who almost always lived off of the rents collected on their lands. The upper aristocratic families later began engaging in business and mining on their estates rather than relying on rents for income. The aristocrats, personified by the crown, represented the blue blood, cream de la cream, or elite of Europe that benefited from hereditary ranks and possessions. The immense estates of Britain's aristocratic class provided their owners with a continuous stream of funds. European royalty and aristocracy lived in supreme luxury. Aristocratic military officers occupied themselves with conquests or the organized suppression of subordinated class groups. The rich always exploited poor men. The democracies, on the other hand, embraced liberal ideas of a more even distribution of wealth to build and safeguard a fair, free, and open society. Their goal was to eliminate government waste. Democracies believed everyone should be given equal opportunity regardless of religion, race, ethnic background, or sexual orientation. The democracies thought that people are greater together than they are on their own, that they should be involved in running their communities. Aristocrats grew fearful of the working class's influence and made concessions to the capitalist bourgeoisie or upper middle classes. Big business, management versus labor, took shape, representing a partial amalgam of aristocratic landowners and corporate magnates. To build fascism, European noble families married their sons or daughters off to wealthy bankers and industrialists. Noble matrimony was the most important, if not the only, ambition of highborn girls. When the Bolshevik Revolution took place in Russia, European aristocracies were quite predictably alarmed. Nazism was invented to counter the Bolshevik danger. Its strategy was to expound the change in Russia as an unsure Jewish state of affairs. The end was to pit German Jews against Russian Jews, to provoke a fratricide, but never to present the solid truth, which fundamentally was a variance between the heraldic and the tolerant. Hitler made great hay from the fact that Kamina, Zinoviev and other early Bolshevik leaders were Jewish, but Hitler not only condemned Bolshevism as a Jewish conspiracy, like he considered Christianity to be a Jewish conspiracy, he also considered finance capitalism to be identical to Bolshevism and lumped the two together as part of one vast Jewish conspiracy. He casually ignored the fact that Jews who were prominent in the early Bolshevik governments were weeded out, made to confess at show trials in Moscow, and either murdered or removed permanently from power. Bruce Walker, wrongfully accused, Jews and Bolshevism, American Thinker, December 9, 2007. Sir Winston Churchill fanned the flames of a Jewish conspiracy premise by suggesting a diplomatic riposte, Zionism. The struggle which is now beginning between the Zionist and Bolshevik Jews is little less than a struggle for the soul of the Jewish people, Churchill claimed without adequate justification. Zionism offers the third sphere to the political conceptions of the Jewish race. In violent contrast to international communism, it presents to the Jew a national idea of a commanding character. It has fallen to the British government, as the result of the conquest of Palestine, to have the opportunity and the responsibility of securing for the Jewish race all over the world a home and center of national life. The statesmanship and historic sense of Mr. Balfour were prompt to seize this opportunity. Declarations have now been made which have irrevocably decided the policy of Great Britain. The fiery energies of Dr. Weissmann, the leader, for practical purposes, of the Zionist project backed by many of the most prominent British Jews, and supported by the full authority of Lord Allenby, are all directed to achieving the success of this inspiring movement. Of course, Palestine is far too small to accommodate more than a fraction of the Jewish race, nor do the majority of national Jews wish to go there. But if, as may well happen, there should be created in our own lifetime by the banks of the Jordan a Jewish state under the protection of the British Crown, which might comprise 3 or 4 millions of Jews, an event would have occurred in the history of the world which would, from every point of view, be beneficial, and would be especially in harmony with the truest interests of the British Empire. Winston S. Churchill, Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People, Illustrated Sunday Herald, February 8, 1920. Winston Churchill, a family member of the Dukes of Marlborough, a branch of the Spencer family, would not acknowledge the friction between nobility and democracy. Instead, he presented a difficult Jewish dilemma and a solution, for the benefit of the British Empire. For some unique reason, Great Britain had the responsibility of securing for the Jewish race all over the earth a home and center of national life. In other words, the Jews of the world were to be constrained to a British dominion, assets of Lord Rothschild. Although they might think the top authority was vested in the Jewish people and exercised directly by them, the truest interests of their Anglo-Saxon masters would in reality take military power over Israel for the great game. According to the Shader's effect on English law, a law of the Jews becomes the law of the land, found in the Georgetown Law Journal, Vol. 71, it was by tradition affirmed that the Jews are the property of the Norman and Anglo-Saxon kings. The treatise explains that the Jews are owned by Great Britain and that the Jews are in charge of the banking system, see page 147. Winston Churchill tried to launch the idea that the 6 million Jews liberated from the pale of Imperial Russia would inevitably support a Bolshevik conspiracy. But at the time of the 1917 October Revolution, only a minority of the Bolsheviks were Jews. Jewish members in the Central Committee, the Politburo's new name, had shrunk to a minority of 3, Trotsky, Zinoviev and Kamenev. Eventually they were all physically eliminated by Joseph Stalin, Zinoviev and Kamenev in 1936 and Trotsky in 1940. In the 1920s, of the 417 members of the Central Executive Committee, the Party Central Committee, the Presidium of the Executive of the Soviets of the USSR and the Russian Republic, the People's Commissars, 6% were ethnic Jews. Jeffrey Herf, The Jewish Enemy, Nazi Propaganda During World War II and the Holocaust, 2008. Jewish Bolsheviks, like other Bolsheviks, were hostile to Judaism. They banned the teaching of Hebrew and religious instruction in Judaism, and they imprisoned Jewish leaders. According to historian Iakov Ettinger, many Soviet state purges of the 1930s were anti-Semitic in nature, and a more intense anti-Semitic policy developed toward the end of World War II. Stalin in 1952 allegedly said privately that every Jew is a potential spy for the United States. Wikipedia.org. Modern researchers have criticized Winston Churchill's scornful concept of Jewish Bolshevism as a prejudice. In 2007, the University of Cambridge issued a news release to publicize a new book by the historian Richard Tuit. The release said that while researching his book, Lloyd George and Churchill, Rivals for Greatness, which chronicles Churchill's relationship with British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, Tuit found an article written by Churchill in 1937 titled How the Jews Can Combat Persecution. While offering advice to Jews, Churchill supposedly wrote that they have been partly responsible for the antagonism from which they suffer. Worse, Churchill allegedly wrote, "The central fact which dominates the relations of Jew and non-Jew is that the Jew is different. He looks different. He thinks differently. He has a different tradition and background." Michael Smirkanish, Churchill, an anti-Semite. The Huffington Post, March 25, 2007. Further, Churchill criticized the Jewish refugees' willingness to work for low wages as bad citizenship, and suggested that it created anti-Semitism because it forced English workers out of jobs. While most people would accept that Churchill was no anti-Semite, this sheds fascinating new light on his views about Jews, which were very inconsistent, said Dr. Richard Tuit, the historian responsible for discovering the document. The article was originally intended for publication in 1937, but was only accepted by the Sunday Dispatch 3 years later. However, by 1940 Churchill had backtracked on his desire to publish the article and refused to allow it to go to print. At the time publication was attempted, he was trying to keep his head down, in political terms, and avoid controversy, Tuit said. Matt Zolin, did Churchill pen anti-Semitic paper? The Jerusalem Post, March 11, 2007. According to the historian Martin Gilbert, Churchill did not write that article, but his ghost writer Adam Marshall Diston did. Diston was a supporter of Oswald Mosley, the notorious fascist and anti-Semite. Nevertheless, why would Sir Winston Churchill employ a professional fascist ghost writer? The American novelist Nicholson Baker was called attention to in the Wall Street Journal. Baker's new history book, Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization, is set to cause rather more of a stir. Based, he claims, on an exhaustive trawl through the U.S. newspapers of the 1920s and 1930s, he portrays Churchill and, to a lesser extent, Roosevelt as brutal, anti-Semitic warmongers who plunged the world into a conflict that could have been avoided. Contemporaneous newspaper reports reveal truths that history books ignore, he argues. Tom Leonard, was Winston Churchill really anti-Semitic? The Telegraph, March 10, 2008. Bolsheviks, including Jewish Bolsheviks, were hostile to Judaism. From December 1918 to August 1919, the teaching of Hebrew was banned, religious instruction in Judaism was forbidden, the Kehillot, an umbrella organization of Jewish communists, was suppressed and the leaders of those organizations were rounded up and imprisoned. In the next decade, anti-Semitism began to appear in Communist Party propaganda, with references by the Vazd against Talmudists. During this period, trials against Jews would put the trials of Dreyfus and Bylus in the shade. Bruce Walker, wrongfully accused, Jews and Bolshevism, American Thinker, December 9, 2007. Fanatic supporters of oligarchy often say that democracy is direct government ruled by the majority or mob rule. But that is quite misleading. Mob rule does not allow discussion or debate, nor does it stand for voting and elections to work. An unsubstantiated mob rule description of democracy is incessantly taught to illiterate groups. Mob rule is the gutter of anarchy, not the doorstep of democracy. Winston Churchill undiplomatically forewarned of a worldwide communistic state under Jewish domination. But it was a meaningless exaggeration. The idea that communist oppression was somehow Jewish in nature is belied by the record of communist regimes in countries like China, North Korea, and Cambodia, where the Jewish presence was and is minuscule. The leading central banking corporations would go even further to deal with the Russian socio-economic challenge. They would sponsor one-party dictators like Joseph Stalin to churn out massacres and discredit the very notion of a democracy surviving beyond the consent of the totalitarian ruling class. Stalin's infamous five-year plans commenced with a trial version in late 1928. Stalin hastened and deepened his plans for Soviet five-year plans, in consultation with Lenin before probably poisoning him. Historians and journalists still discuss the subject. In May 1922, Lenin suffered the first of a series of strokes. When he died in 1924, supposedly from syphilis, the country's leadership was taken over by Joseph Stalin, 1879-1953, Iosif Vissarionovich Djugashvili, after a bitter fight with Leon Trotsky. Trotsky was expelled from the party by Stalin in 1927, and then exiled from the country in 1929. In exile, he attempted to mobilize other communist groups against Stalin. David Alan Rivera, Stalin and Western Support of the Soviet Union, 1994. Stalin was also soon able to peddle his plans as a national security surrogate in a young USSR menaced by hostile scheming capitalists. Having an uber-powerful and deadly secret police, and the cult of semi-random violence using disappearance in the night, helped him a lot. The world's central bankers, who heavily invested both in Stalin and in Hitler, helped even more. Major private bankers were of course also on board from the start. One famous example is the grandfather of George W. Bush, who before, during and after the 1941 termination of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, and declaration of war between Nazi Germany and the USSR, and between the US and Germany, continued to invest in both. Andrew MacKillop, Stalin, Hitler, and the Five-Year Plans of Banksters, The Market Oracle, April 27, 2014. On August 20, 1940, Soviet undercover agent Ramon Mercader attacked Leon Trotsky in his home in Mexico with a mountaineer's ice axe. Trotsky survived for more than a day, dying on August 21, 1940. At his trial, Mercader testified, "I laid my raincoat on the table in such a way as to be able to remove the ice axe which was in the pocket. I decided not to miss the wonderful opportunity that presented itself. The moment Trotsky began reading the article, he gave me my chance. I took out the ice axe from the raincoat, gripped it in my hand and, with my eyes closed, dealt him a terrible blow on the head." US President Roosevelt signed the Lend-Lease Bill in 1941 to give aid to the Soviets, France, China, and other Allied nations during World War II. Originally, it was meant to aid Great Britain in its war effort against the Germans. Later, Dresser Industries, whose directors included Prescott Bush, built a $146 million plant at Kuibyshev to produce high-quality drill bits for oil exploration. The C.E. Lumisco of New Jersey built a $105 million petrochemical plant in the Ukraine. $45 million would be put up by Lummis through financing from Exim Bank and other private banks, which was guaranteed by the OPIC. Alice Chalmers built a $35 million iron ore pelletizing plant in Russia, which is one of the world's four largest. The Aluminum Co. of America, Alcoa, built an aluminum plant, which consumed half the world's supply of bauxite. "We sent the Russians computer systems, oil drilling equipment, pipes, and other supplies. The ball bearings used by Russia to improve the guidance systems on their rockets and missiles, such as their SS-18 intercontinental ballistic missiles, were purchased in 1972 from the Bryant Grinder Co. in Springfield, Vermont." All of this financial aid to Russia was advocated by Henry Kissinger and the US government. The reasoning behind it was to allow Russia to increase their industrial and agricultural output to match ours, because by bringing the two countries closer together, hostilities would be eased. They were not. David Alan Rivera, Stalin and Western Support of the Soviet Union, 1994.